Welcome back to iGen Politics. This is a podcast that makes politics engaging and relevant for all generations. This is Victor Shi.
And I'm Jill Wine Banks, and today's hashtag Jill's Pin seemed appropriate to me for today's topic. It was actually originally used for the Theranos trial, which was about testing blood. But in some ways, so is this issue.
A recent headline read, Trump's White House was awash in Speed and Xanax. I'm not making that up. Last week, Rolling Stone published a piece that detailed how many members of Donald Trump's White House had easy access to stimulants and sedatives enabled by the White House medical unit and the president's physician, Dr. Ronny Jackson, who we'll talk about during this episode. It's a story that would be laughable if it weren't so serious because it captures just how sharply the Trump White House deviated from norms, laws, and rules that every administration prior followed. And it's yet another reminder as we inch closer to Election Day of whether we want those types of stories as our headlines, or if we want the positive policies that have been passed under President Biden.
Today, we're going to talk about that story with the person who wrote it, Noah Schachtman. Until March 1st of this year, Noah served as the editor-in-chief of Rolling Stone magazine, where he scrutinized the rich and powerful. Before that, Noah was the editor-in-chief of the Daily Beast, where one of the main projects he did was modernizing their website by making it more digital-friendly. We are thrilled to have Noah on the podcast to talk about his story and more. Noah, we're so glad to have you. Thank you for being with us.
My God, thanks for having me.
No, it's great to see you, and we are very excited about this conversation. We want to start off by talking about this story that you wrote about the White House being awash in Speed and Xanax. First, how did you learn about this story and start looking into this matter?
Yeah, so there was, in the beginning of January, there was a report from the Pentagon Inspector General. That's kind of like their own internal investigators. That was looking into misuse of what's known as the White House Medical Office. It's a branch of the military stationed in the White House that's responsible for the medical care of the president, vice president, senior officials, and the military staff that work there. And in this report, it said that the handling of prescription medications was really sloppy and really off. And that was kind of interesting. And then buried on page like 14 or 15 of this report was a handwritten ledger that they said came from the White House Medical Office of just like a cocktail of the most powerful sedatives and stimulants you can imagine. And I was like, what the hell is this? Like, let's see if we can get to the bottom of what's actually going on here. And I think we did.
You definitely did. I just want to explain for our listeners that the reason that the Inspector General for the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, would be involved is because the doctor at the White House is part of the Pentagon. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. He's usually a Navy captain. Right. And in Navy terms, that's just below admiral. So it's usually someone like that. The armed services have a long history of having top flight doctors and sometimes they're MDs, sometimes they're osteopaths, but you know, they often have doctors, and usually the physician of the president is some kind of Navy man. And that's the case now with Biden, and it's been the case before.
Right. And we'll talk about the specifics of who this person was, Ronny Jackson, later. But I want to get the basics of the story out first. And that involves your mentioning the fact that the medical unit for the White House ordered thousands of doses of I'm not sure I'm saying it right, Modafinil
and
Modafinil. Thank you. Which is a stimulant used by military pilots to stay alert during night flights and long flights. Right. And is this the first time in history that this has ever happened? Is there any other record of stimulants and Xanax, you know, sleep medications being doled out so much at the White House?
So there's certainly been a long history of some pretty powerful prescription medicines at the White House. JFK famously used a real cocktail of pharmaceuticals to treat his back issues. Richard Nixon, when things got bad, turned to some pretty powerful medicines. But this seems to be, and I should add, it is fairly common in a White House to give out Ambien for long flights, or even, some kind of mild stimulant to cope with jet lag. All of those things are pretty standard. What's new and different and weird here is sort of an industrial level use of this military grade stimulant called modafinil. It's really That is very unusual. And what's particularly unusual is that they weren't using it for long flights or anything like that. They were using it just to kind of like keep up with the manic, frenetic pace of dealing with Donald Trump. And moreover, they were using so much of it that then to come down at all, they had to take a powerful sedative and anti-anxiety medication called Xanax. And so you had this kind of real roller coaster situation going on for many at the White House, where one pill gets you up and the other gets you down, and the cycle continues.
So I
One of the
have a
things,
follow-up
yeah, go ahead.
question, but I also want to comment that, of course, having lived through both the Kennedy and the Nixon administrations, Kennedy had a war injury and very serious back problems that had to be treated. He had a special rocking chair. And the usage, from what you're saying, was limited to treating his medical condition. Richard Nixon did fall into, he had phlebitis and some other things, but he obviously fell into tough times during Watergate when he abused alcohol. And I guess from what you're saying, he also abused some medications. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's at least that's been the reporting that's come out, subsequently.
Victor, you
Yeah,
had a
well, I mean, one of the things as I was listening to you say this compared to past administrations, is one of the things I found intriguing about your piece in particular was that you mentioned how the White House doctor, and we'll get to Dr. Jackson in a second, but he didn't diagnose anyone before he gave out these sort of medications. And is that correct? And tell us sort of what it was like in past administrations. Were there diagnoses before those medications were actually prescribed?
Right. So you probably wouldn't need a diagnosis for Ambien or something like that, right? Okay, you need to fall asleep on this flight. Here you go. And that was something more like you'd record. But for more powerful medications, absolutely. You'd need some kind of prescription. And that was really not the case in the Trump White House. It was what one insider called the quote, Wild West, where whatever someone needed, they would get. And the need is, I'd use some pretty heavy air quotes there. And so there was a real expectation that you could go to the White House doctors, kind of demand a prescription medication, to alter your mood, and they would give it up. And the higher up in the food chain you were, the more likely you were to get it. So that was the expectation going on. And that is highly unusual, highly irregular. And it's the kind of thing, look, my wife's a physician. And that's the kind of thing, like if you did in civilian life, you'd lose your medical license. Like you can't just hand out controlled substances willy-nilly, just because, just because someone says, gimme. Like that's the kind of thing that turns you from a doctor to an ex-doctor.
So I understand the doctor might have to lose his or her license for doling them out in this way, but what about government employees? It's my understanding they have to take drug tests in order to get the job. If they fail the drug test, they don't get the job. If after they're hired, do they have to keep taking drug tests? And is this something that would show up and be problematic?
Don't know about the drug test part of this. What I do know is that If you have a actual medical condition and you need to take Xanax, for actual diagnosed anxiety, for example, that's not going to affect your status as a government employee or as a member of the military and your secret clearance or top secret clearance even. What definitely could affect your clearance is if you're popping pills without a diagnosis, right? That's not that, and your judgment is impaired, and you're doing this outside of a traditional medical supervision. That could really get your clearance in trouble. I don't believe that happened in the Trump White House, however.
Interesting. So who knew about this besides Dr. Ronny Jackson? And was there any sort of oversight or accountability into this?
Right. So you mentioned Ronny Jackson a couple of times. So let's just zoom back and talk about him for a second. So Ronny Jackson was a Navy man and a doctor. He actually had served in numerous administrations, served in the George W. Bush administration. He'd served as kind of the deputy in the, sorry, that was my dog barking there. He served as a deputy in the Obama White House. And then in, I want to say 2013, 2014, became, essentially physician of the president under Obama. And he'd always been viewed as kind of like an eccentric, kind of a weirdo, but good at his job. And I would say that over the Obama years, he went from sort of eccentric to unhinged. And there were numerous previous Pentagon reports into his behavior, including an infamous trip overseas where he got wasted and started banging on a female subordinate's hotel room door and kind of demanding she come out, and then winding up in a drunken pile on the floor. There were allegations that he crashed a car while drunk. There's all kinds of personal behavioral issues with him. He then served in the Trump administration, and it seems like the kind of fast and loose behavior, let's call it, got even faster and looser, and started really handing out these pills, to seemingly anybody, anytime, anywhere. And even though he then left the Trump White House, he sort of went in and out a little bit, and finally left in 2019 to go run for Congress. And he is now a sitting congressman, believe it or not. His people were very much in charge of the White House medical office. His way of doing business was very much the way of doing business there. And so even though he had left, his legacy had kind of lived on. So he's very, so I didn't quite answer your question there, but I just want to give the background on Ronny Jackson.
Well, that's important, but I have to stop you because it's astounding to me listening to this behavioral, provable thing that he wasn't fired. How do you pound on someone's door and then collapse in a drunken stupor during a presidential trip? And I believe this was, if not widely known, it was known and reported. How do you crash a car and keep on being the president's physician? What's the explanation for that? Is there any explanation?
I don't have a good one. I'm sorry, I just don't have a good one. I prob you know, because I was really focused on the pharmaceutical distribution for this story, and another issue that I hope we'll get into in a second, I didn't closely track how Ronny Jackson managed to escape.
I think you have a second story here. You should follow this. This is a fascinating story.
Washington Post did do a pretty deep dive on that, and I will note, it's come out subsequently that Jackson, who had retired as an admiral, had gotten subsequently demoted, qu quietly demoted, sort of after his retirement, back down to captain, and that has some financial implications for people with pension. It has some reputational implications, but clearly, it doesn't diminish the fact that this guy was, according to dozens and dozens and dozens of people in the know, was able to act like a complete fucking maniac and really abuse his power and really create a culture of fear within the White House medical office, and really got away with it. And that behavior started in the Obama administration, then, you know, radically accelerated in the Trump administration.
Do you have any knowledge? And you mentioned a little bit about how the higher up you got at the White House, the more easy access you had to these drugs. But do you have any knowledge into the drug users themselves, or how many people, if there's anyone besides employees of the White House and either administration or agency officials?
I do, but I can't talk about it. I feel like I'm at doctor-patient confidentiality, and
sure.
I feel comfortable with it. I don't have a sense of exactly how widespread it was, but I do have a sense of kind of who or I know of some people that for sure got this, but I don't feel comfortable with it. What I do know is that some of these folks not only were taking these pretty powerful medications like Xanax, but then they were downing it with, they were drinking at night in combination. And look, I was a musician in a previous life, so I may have heard about some people who once or twice combined downers with alcohol for a pretty powerful combo. And you know, that's the kind of thing that that can have really serious medical effects. And pardon me, and can be just incredibly dangerous. And let alone the fact that, you know, it's not exactly conducive to clarity of thinking. And then you can imagine, you black out because of pills and booze. Then you got to wake up in the morning and take a stimulant just to like kick your ass awake. So it's a pretty toxic cycle if you get on it. So, wow.
So let me ask you another question. In terms of drug use, I have not read about any in any recent administration other than this article about the Trump administration. But there was some white powdery substance discovered during Biden's term in the White House, which turned out to be nothing as far as I know. Is there any enlightenment you can shed on that?
I don't, but I mean, my understanding of that case was it was in more of the visitor's area. Okay. Yeah, that was found. And so it's not clear that was White House staff. And look, let's just assume it was cocaine, okay? Like, let's just say it was. And let's even say it was a White House staffer, right? That happens. Guess what? There's going to be people, I'm sure there have been people who've, White House staffers who have taken cocaine going back at least to the Carter years, right? But the difference here is this is a government employee, a high-ranking government employee supervising the distribution of very powerful narcotics and stimulants. That is very different from somebody copping a dime bag in DuPont Circle, okay? Like, that is just not the same thing. And so I think that's the, you know, look, you've got a lot of, you know, given any certain, you know, number of humans, like some of them are going to be taking some drugs recreationally. Fine. Listen, this is a story for Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone is not exactly anti-drug. Okay. What's different here is one set of rules for government employees, for White House employees, another set of rules for the rest of us. What's at issue here is that this was sanctioned. This was, in effect, White House sanctioned drug dealing to its own staff.
Did the users pay for the drugs, or is this doled out on taxpayer money?
I don't 100% know the answer to that, but my educated guess would be this is all on taxpayer money.
Wow. Wow.
I mean, that I think leads to us asking, I mean, can there be accountability in some way? I know that Dr. Jackson isn't the White House visitor now, but is there any mechanism for accountability here?
Yeah, I think this is an unsatisfying answer, but I think it's going to have to be through that. I think for the medical professionals, it would be through their licensing boards. And I think, you know, I do think they've got some really serious questions to answer. And then I think we kind of need to talk about what to me was the most serious breach of medical ethics, potentially at least, which was in addition to a carelessness with how they handed out medication, there seems to be a carelessness, perhaps deliberately so, with confidential patient information. And so I found a mental health worker who was brought in to treat various members of the Trump administration. And after this source was done counseling Trump administration officials, folks from the White House medical office would immediately pump this person for information about what was said in the confidential counseling sessions. Now, maybe it's just because my wife is a shrink, but to me, that's the most egregious breach of ethics that I can think of. You know, that information is really supposed to be kept confidential. Now, I spoke to one of the heads of the White House medical office who said that, well, it was just basically to make sure that this is just for military officers. And it was just to make sure that, you know, there wasn't anything that was going to affect their top secret security clearances. But that's a dodge at best. The mental health professional that I spoke to saw both military and civilian people, and the source really felt like this went far beyond any sort of like top line, is this person fit for duty or not, and really led down a dangerously slippery slope.
That sounds equally terrible to me. I'm not sure whether I weigh a mass distribution of drugs to White House employees as worse or less awful than the breach of confidentiality, but both are problems.
It ain't great either way.
Exactly. So let's just talk about you a little bit too, because you've had an interesting career. You've been editing magazines and writing for magazines. And so we want to talk a little bit more about that. And we've interviewed a lot of journalists, but not people who do the editing, which is a really critical function that I think people don't always pay enough attention to. So how did you first get involved in magazines? And what do you think the future of magazines is, given what's happened to the media structure now? Let's start with that.
Geez, that's like seven questions in once there, counselor.
Well, just two. Okay. How did you get involved? We'll start with that one.
So, it's a bit of a long story, but let's say there was a long period in my life where I was freelance writing while I was home and then playing music and going on the road. And I did that for a long time. And then, but I mean, I was really an amateur at journalism, and you know, I could write a little bit, but I didn't really know much about reporting. So much so that when 9/11 happened, and I'm a resident of Lower Manhattan, I didn't even know what to do. You know, I wasn't even sure how to respond. But I was freelancing a little bit for some technology magazines, and so a few days after 9/11, I wrote a story about these robotic planes that were going to go after Osama bin Laden. And we now know those to be drones, and they're very common. But at the time, it was like, whoa, what the hell? And people got really excited about that story, and so I started doing one after the other, on kind of national security and technology and the intersection of those two. And after a few years of that, I decided that this was really going somewhere, and I better really pursue this. And frankly, I was, 32, 33 years old, and being in the back of the van was getting a little old. And so I started writing full time, to make to try to compress a pretty long story. Wired was kind of my primary home, while I would also write for the Times and your hometown Chicago Trib, and the Washington Post, and what have you. And went overseas a bunch of times, to do reporting, Afghanistan and Iraq, and did that through, let's call it 2013. And then I decided to take kind of like my first management job, helping run a magazine called Foreign Policy, which is not as boring as it sounds. That didn't last very long because, for reasons out of my control, that went from being a job that I'd have to commute one day every other week to Washington, D.C., to a job where I had to commute 3 days a week to Washington, D.C., from Brooklyn. And I had a 3-month-old and a 3-year-old at home, and my wife was ready to murder me. So fortunately, I was able to get a job as the executive editor of the Daily Beast, which I did for several years, then became editor in chief. And then frankly, I was ready. What I had promised myself all throughout 2020 was that the day after the election, I'd quit and go spend some time in the woods, or just not be on this crazy train. And then, like, kind of the election never ended, right? And then January 6th happened, and so things got extended out. And then I got a call about whether I was interested in running Rolling Stone. And given my music background and my journalism background, it was an offer I couldn't refuse.
Can you talk more about your music background? We
Sure.
haven't.
Sure. So I was New York is kind of funny. This is where I grew up, and it's the kind of thing, like, your high school band, like, they don't play like the sock hop or whatever, they don't play the dance. Like, you wind up, if you're any good, you wind up playing like real clubs, like where real big bands play. And so, me and all my friends throughout the city that had bands, like, we all did that. And it was kind of a wild experience for, I mean, so, the first time I played this famous punk rock club in New York called CBGB's, like, we had to sneak in to play because we weren't old enough to win. And the age limit was 16. So just to give you a sense of, like,
Whoa.
yeah, like, we had to sneak in because we weren't 16 yet. So did that. I had bands in college. And then when I came back to New York, a lot of my friends that I'd grown up with had, like, really, like, some of them didn't go to college or stayed in New York and were, like, much further along in their musical careers. And so I was lucky that I got to kind of, like, team up with my old friends, and a lot of them were, touring, had record deals and stuff like that. And so I was able to kind of tag along with them and do some session work on, and some sideman work on my own, for a number of years, and until, I was doing really seriously through, let's say, 2023, and then a little, I mean, excuse me, 2003, and then, less seriously after that. And so it was great prep for Rolling Stone, because it meant that, like, there's a lot of musicians that, like, you could just talk shop with them, and it wasn't like, they knew that they were talking to somebody that knew music itself and knew the touring life, or knew the musician's life. And I had a really fun run there for 3 years, and which just ended recently. And one of the reasons why is because I really want to get back to writing and doing some of the stories, like this White House Pill Mill story that we're talking about today.
Well, I have two really quick follow-up questions. The first is a little bit lighthearted. What was your instrument when you were playing?
Well, bass guitar. which is really
okay.
really good because everybody always needs a bass player, and or at least did back then, and it was also good because the bass only has four strings, and you know, I'm musical but not that musical, so that is
evident. Yeah, well, that's actually part of the reason why I quit piano, because there were, I don't know how many keys there are on a piano, but I got through a lot. So the next question I have to ask you is, you know, you mentioned a little bit about sort of going back into writing and then your time editing. For a lot of young listeners who are thinking about starting a career, what is the difference between being an editor at a news publication versus being a journalist? And maybe walk us through sort of what your day-to-day life was like as an editor.
Yeah, sure. I'm sorry. So the difference, just so I understand the question, it's what's the difference between being a writer and an editor? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
So fine. So the way I like to liken it is it's a little bit between like the difference between being a point guard and a shooting guard in basketball. And like, you know, if you're a shooting guard, it's your job to score, right? It's your job to score all the time. And if you're a point guard, it's your job to set other people up, right? To get assists. And so the editor is really there to make sure that like their writers are pursuing the right kind of stories, you know, really are attacking the right kind of targets, and then helping them with the prose and making sure that that prose is as sharp as possible. And then making sure it's really up to standard and you know, making sure that if you're, you know, the more seriously you make a particular claim, the more sources you have for it, and to make sure that like you can really, that those claims will really withstand scrutiny. And then as you move up further, then, you know, in editing, then you want to make sure that you're setting a tone and mission for the entire organization. And, you know, what is the place really about and why are we doing this? You know, because all journalism work is a pain in the ass. And so why are we getting up and doing this every day? And then, you know, as you go up, then there's more and more interface with the business side also, and making sure that like, you know, not only are you, you know, if you've got a certain travel budget or freelance budget that you're working within it, and making sure that, you know, you sort of, to use another hackneyed sports analogy, you're playing a game of Moneyball where, you know, you've got a certain amount of money for staff, and are you spending it on the right people and in the right amounts?
So,
and make sure that you don't that you know, you don't compromise your journalism, but you don't, you know, fuck up the ad side either, do badly with it. And so that's sort of like, as you're moving up, that's sort of like what the job entails.
So you've worked for both serious print publications, but you've also done a lot of online, and you really modernized as editor-in-chief the online. Talk about the difference between print publications that are actually delivered to people's homes and those that are online that are delivered through a very different medium, and whether you think that with all the new media platforms, print will survive.
Yeah. So I would say, first of all, there's almost no place now that's like print only, right? I mean, there's basically no place. And I think, that being said, there's still a lot of people in my industry that think print first or print only. And, you know, I think that's a giant mistake. You know, the fact of the matter is, you know, take Rolling Stone, for example, you know, the magazine, you know, gets distributed in print to a few hundred thousand people, you know, but on any given day, there's a million visitors per day to the website, right? So it's just a complete difference of scale, a few hundred thousand per month versus, you know, millions per day. Oh, sorry. Hold on a second. Let me, my wife just came home. Let me just close the door real quick. So look, I think, but look, my big thing is like journalism is journalism, and you shouldn't get too caught up in the delivery mechanism, right? Sound principles of reporting apply whether you're on Dead Trees or TikToks or newsletters or anything, right? That like, or television, you know, or podcasting. It's like the rules of journalism apply no matter what. And so, you know, one thing I've tried to do in my career is just make sure that you know, the kind of rigor that you'd want to see in a premium print publication, that that's applied to multiple media, and that's applied to podcasting, that's applied to video, and that's applied to you know, web-based journalism.
So, oh, go ahead, Jill. Yeah.
No, you go ahead, Victor.
I was going to say one of the things you wanted to ask you about is there's a lot of talk about how the media covers both Biden and Trump. And we're wondering sort of what your thoughts are on sort of the media sort of framing of both candidates and why they focus so much on things like Biden's age, so little on his accomplishments, and so little on Trump's age and the danger that he poses on democracy, and sort of giving us an insight into how those sort of decisions are made inside a newsroom. Is that intentional? What would you do if you were running a publication right now on those sort of really hot button issues?
Yeah. So, look, I think Biden's age is a super legitimate issue. You know, now he may, I think it's something we got to grapple with. And I think it's something we got to grapple with in this country that, like, you know, we've essentially got a gerontocracy running Washington, D.C. And, you know, how does that play out in terms of policy? How does that play out in terms of effective government? I think it's a really big issue. Now, I also, so that's thought number one. I'm going to ask you to hold a couple of thoughts in your head simultaneously. Thought number two is, you know, Donald Trump is a, you know, is a fascist and represents an existential threat to democracy. And, you know, that fact is far more important than any declines that Biden may have seen because of his age. But it's not, but I think both issues are like, I don't mean to, I'm not trying to both sides those issues, but I am saying that like you do have to hold both of those things in your head. And you know, that it's important to do so. I think that the media right now is engaged. Everybody knows what a serious threat Trump is, I think, in the media. And by the way, that includes the folks in the conservative media too. I mean, any of, just to be clear, there's actually nobody who authentically supports Trump and his agenda, you know, in the conservative press, and that includes Fox News. They're trying to use Trump's audience. They're trying to hijack Trump's audience. They're trying to get right with Trump's audience, but they don't actually believe what he says. And I mean, I know a lot of people in that space, and they all, you know, off air think what's going, you know, that Trump is a fucking maniac. But I think there's some fatigue among the media in terms of how do you continue to describe the, you know, weird, baroque, horrifying, scary ways in which Trump acts. I think there's a little bit of running at, you know, I think it's like how many times you use a superlative. You know, so I think that's a real issue. I think there's a little bit of early Trump administration. I think there's a little bit of burnout in which things that seemed to be, you know, existential, you know, kind of administration ending issues for Trump wound up not being. And I think there was some overhyping about those issues. So I think that's taking place. And then finally, I think there's a, you know, and I saw this in 2016 with Hillary too, you know, there's a real desire during election years among the ownership class of the media to appear like even-handed, or at least to appear that you're not weighing too much to one side or another. And so I think that that last part is leading to some really strange coverage decisions. So the other day, this fellow, Robert Herr, who was a special counsel who, sort of was supposed to investigate some mishandling of classified information by Biden, instead, you know, turned into a kind of thesis on whether Biden was all mentally there. He released this report in which he basically just punked the media and you know, sort of said that while Biden might be able to portray himself as a kind of fumbling, you know, Mr. Magoo, grandpa, you know, forgetful type, and the media like ran with that in a way that I haven't seen since Hillary's emails. And it turned out they were played. You know, it turned out that the transcripts of the interviews that Biden gave, while there was some memory losses, it certainly was well within the bounds of what you'd expect for hours and hours of interviews. And Jill, I'm sure you can speak to that. But, you know, I thought it was telling that Herr himself had memory issues about what was said it's something that, and now, you know, having done this for a couple of decades, it's a trap that the media falls into from time to time, where in an attempt to appear even-handed and at the directive of kind of the often, you know, plutocrat owners, they kind of forget their own principles and kind of lose sight of just some basic journalism. And so, you know, I think you saw that with Hillary's emails. I think you saw that, you know, in the run-up to the Iraq war, is another great example of that, where just, you know, people kind of like forgot how to really do some basics. And I'm worried about that with Biden's age now. I think his State of the Union address, actually, in some ways, while it addressed it, I think it addressed it kind of a little bit at the expense of like actually talking to voters, if that makes sense. Like, you know, I think he was so committed to showing that he still got it, baby. And it was really aimed at the kind of like top editors and chattering class, that I wonder whether he missed a little bit of an opportunity to really talk kitchen table. Could be wrong, but that was the reaction I had when I was.
I think you can easily, as you said, hold two thoughts in your mind at once. And Victor and I have frequently talked about and had journalists on to talk about what we see as the totally unfair coverage, ignoring Trump's age, which is not that much younger, ignoring the many, many misstatements that Donald Trump has, not remembering his wife's name, not remembering Nancy Pelosi is different than Nikki Haley. All of those things are, you know, equally troublesome, but and recognizing that there are serious concerns among voters about age for both of them, and that Biden had to address that at least. But I love your comment about Herr, because to me it was so ironic to be talking about Biden's memory when he was interviewed the day after October 7th, the attack by Gaza on Israel, and was dealing with an international crisis, but still didn't want to cancel his prearranged appointment. And so remember the exact day of his son's death, and then the report doesn't mention that. And then when he's being asked questions, he says, well, I'm not sure I can remember that. And this is a report that he wrote just minutes ago, not years ago. So I think your point there is quite quite on point in terms of average memory. And this is for a trained prosecutor who was prepared for this, who just wrote the most important interview for a job in the new administration, if there is a second Trump administration. So I love that point of yours.
Yeah. Thank you. One other thing, I feel like in 2020, like, I don't know how this happened exactly, but like everybody in the media decided that the gaffes and the verbal slip-ups by both candidates were just not a story. Like, that's how the age issue in some ways was handled 4 years ago. It was just like, because both of these guys put their foot in their mouth all the time, right? And I don't know why exactly that's changed now. I'm not saying that the decision 4 years ago was right, just to be clear. Like, maybe we should have focused on that. But I do find it interesting that, like, it was just viewed as, like, this is just not, this is just not a topic worthy of coverage. And it's interesting to me that, you know, that, like, Nikki Haley, Nancy Pelosi slip up, if that had happened 4 years ago with Trump, nobody would have said jack shit. Even on the left, nobody would have said anything. So, I mean, maybe it was just because we were dealing with COVID and, you know, the stakes, you know, seemed very present. I'm not sure, but I do find it curious that it was sort of like, seems to have moved the goalpost a little bit on what's worthy of coverage. I think the other thing, though, I just want to be clear here is, like, I don't want to underestimate or discount, because I think, you know, because the election is so serious, I don't want to discount the degree to which I think Biden is has alienated, you know, some of the young voters that you know were so crucial to his election 4 years ago. I think his relative absence on the stage has really served him poorly over the last several years. I think that that relative absence, coupled with the relative absence of Kamala Harris and or someone else that could be kind of his, you know, spokesperson or surrogate, I think has really served him poorly. I think, I think, in addition to that, you know, Biden's decision to bear hug Bibi Netanyahu, who is a snake and, you know, someone who, you know, pretty openly called for the assassination of his predecessor and who then was assassinated, and has been a thorn in and has, you know, screwed over Biden personally on any number of occasions back when Biden was vice president. I found that to be a really odd move. And, you know, I say this as somebody who, like, I went to school in Israel. I went to Hebrew University in Jerusalem. So, like, you know, I'm not taking second place to anybody in terms of how I feel about the country. But I think Biden, you know, his relative absence, his unwillingness maybe to trumpet his own accomplishments on things like climate and student debt, and then this bear hug of Netanyahu, haven't been a tough place, I think, with young people or with a lot of young people. And, you know, I think back to a editorial meeting we had a couple of months ago. And, you know, as you can imagine, Rolling Stone staff is predominantly, you know, under 35. And we were talking about potential political covers, and we batted around a number of potential covers. And we said, what about Biden? And everybody's response was, fuck no. And that doesn't mean they're not going to vote for him, but they ain't happy about it. And this should be an easy, given Biden's record, his actual record, given who's on the other side, this should be an easy and enthusiastic choice. And it's not going to be. And it's making this election into a nail biter that it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because last week's State of the Union, I would mark a shift in that. There was a New York Times piece in which one of his senior advisors said, we're going to let Biden be Biden. At least I feel like part of this sort of struggle for this administration is they've been very protective around both Vice President Harris and President Biden. Hopefully, after this, he can get back on the campaign trail and really be, as you said, public and engage with people in a more aggressive and sustained way and in a way that's not as sort of controlled by his staffers. But we'll see. It'll be a tough election cycle. And I know a lot of young people are, I think, dissatisfied, and hopefully there's enough time to shift minds. But we appreciate you coming on, and we also appreciate this conversation. So thank you, Noah, for coming on, and we look forward to hopefully talking to you again soon.
Cool. Thanks. Great conversation. Thanks, guys.